evening all. This is my friend, Reverend Rick Buckman, who has been with me at Green Gulch and Asahara for many years, and is a disciple of Zoketsu Norman Fisher. And he's now the teacher at a kind of a sister sangha of ours, because it's right over in Salinas, across the way. Been there for the last year and a half, and it's a Franciscan worker interfaith community, and you'll probably hear more about that. Mainly working with the homeless community in Salinas. So thank you very much, Rick, for coming.
Thank you. Good evening. Reverend Kokio, you didn't tell me you were going to record this.
Is it okay?
Is it too late to back out?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I like to tell a story that maybe embarrasses Reverend Kokio a little bit. I don't know. I've never asked him. I just tell it anyway. Back in 1991, my first summer at Tassahara. Interestingly, I was embarrassed about the amount of food that I had at dinner tonight. And our very first encounter in the meal area at Tassahara during the summer, I had more food on my plate than I wanted to eat. And there was this guy sitting next to me, long beard, dreadlocks, said, "It's okay, man. The earth will take it back." There he is. And that was my first introduction to Reverend Kokio, and we've been Dharma brothers and friends ever since. I won't say anymore. I'll stop at that. I've tested our friendship enough. As Kokio said, I'm in Salinas. About a year ago, I was asked to become mission director of a nonprofit organization that serves the homeless in Salinas. It started out as a Catholic worker house 29 years ago, and it's morphed into an interfaith community. And what I'd like to talk about tonight, is not so much the details of the organization or how I ended up there, although maybe during tea or during question and answer I would be happy to talk about that. But I felt more appropriate for a Dharma talk is to try to express on a personal level what where I am at now, how that has affected my path, my Dharma path, and what I feel or think I may be learning from an entirely different realm, from the realm in which Kokio and I lived and practiced for 18, 20 years together. Over dinner with Shoho and Kokio, I made a statement that I've said in numerous other venues than the last year and a half that I've been working with the severely traumatized people on Soledad Street in Salinas. I've grown more in that year and a half than I did during the 2 decades I spent at Zen Center. And that's not a disparagement of Zen Center at all. I would be dead meat had it not been for the training I received at Zen Center. And I wouldn't have been able to face what I'm facing and learn what I'm learning, I think learning, in my present experience. And what better way to do that than talk about Genjo Koan? Anybody here know what I mean by Genjo Koan? Of course. So, a little bit about the term from what I learned from Okamura Sensei's new book. The word gen means to appear, to show up, to be in the present moment. And Okamura uses the image of the moon appearing from behind clouds, or somebody appearing from out from within a house, that kind of appearance. You know. You didn't see it, now you see it. Something was obscuring it, or it was contained inside of something, but now it's revealed. That's again. And Jo means to realize, to complete, to accomplish, or to actualize. So, the realization of the appearance, or the moment of the appearance, the occurrence, and awareness of the appearance, of the occurrence, would be what the word Genjo means. And I'm not going to address the word koan. That's more pertinent for what I want to try to say, is that image of the moon appearing from behind the clouds. It's the appearance of the present moment in all of its wonder and depth from behind the prejudices and presuppositions that we perpetually bring to the present moment. And we always bring some kind of prejudice or presupposition to the moment. I feel we can't not do this. It's just how we see things. We see glasses. We bring that from our experience, from our enculturation. We bring samskaras to our experience. This is a cup, and it is water. Those are samskaras. Those are the clouds, and it's not wrong to have clouds. It's not a mistake. But if all we see are the clouds, then we don't see the moon. If all we see is the samskara that we overlay onto the present moment, then we don't see the depth and the emptiness and the flashing into existence of each and everything in the present moment. So that image of the moon appearing from behind the clouds is an image for Zen, Zazen practice. And by Zazen practice, I don't simply mean sitting on a cushion, but the attitudinal posture that the practitioner brings to the experience of the present moment. Clouds and moonlight. And I want to try to say a little bit more about that. That attitudinal posture, that way of holding experience. Zen Master Tozan wrote a poem about clouds, white clouds, and blue mountain. He said the blue mountain is the father of the white clouds. The white cloud is the sun of the blue mountain. All day long, they depend on each other. Without being dependent on each other, the white cloud is always the white cloud. The blue mountain is always the blue mountain. This kind of interrelationship all day long, they're interacting with each other. Yet they're independent, yet they're not disturbing one another. White clouds are dharmas with a small d. Events in consciousness. It could be a sound, like the children out there. It could be a sensation, the knees. It could be a feeling or a thought. So that's the clouds. And the Blue Mountain is the space in which these phenomena arise. Clouds are not a problem. The posture of Zazen is to see how the clouds and the mountain are interacting with one another all day long. The clouds are circling around that mountain, and the mountain is steadfast, unmoving. The clouds are moving. So this is the dynamic of Zazen. It's not pushing away thoughts to find some other realm where we're not disturbed by clouds. If we were to succeed in doing that, we would have yet another dharma with a small d, another phenomenon, another kind of cloud, a peaceful, empty cloud, but nonetheless a cloud. The fullness of our experience, the fullness of our life, and the depth of the meaning of our life is to see through the clouds the mountain, to see through the clouds the moonlight. And it's hard to articulate. It's hard to talk about. For one reason, the mountain doesn't exist. The clouds don't exist either. Well, we think they do. The various dharmas are empty. But we think they do. And our thinking they exist obscures the awareness is not quite the right word. Obscures the context of the moonlight or the mountain. The mountain doesn't exist, the clouds don't exist. But we think the clouds exist. And we may think the mountain doesn't exist and therefore it's not real. The clouds are real, but they don't exist. The mountain is also real, but it's not a dharma. It's not a phenomenon that you can experience. It cannot become an object that you can grasp with your consciousness. But holding this space, we can begin to appreciate the vastness and the imperturbability of the mountain. So that's and hopefully, as I talk more, what I'm trying to say about this attitudinal posture, about this dynamic of the clouds and the Blue Mountain that Tozan speaks of, will maybe be a little bit clearer. Maybe not, but we'll see. But once again, Genjo, to realize the Gen part, pardon me, it's to appear, to show up. The moon appearing from behind the clouds. Or the depths of the present moment appearing from behind the samskaras, behind the conceptual overlays that we bring to experience. And I gave an example of the cup, the glasses, but another example is the constellation Orion. The constellation Orion does not exist. Yet every time I look at a certain point of the winter sky, I see the constellation Orion. I see that pattern, the three stars for the belt and the sword. And obviously there's not a belt or a sword up in the sky. But that pattern is pure mental formation. But when the heart and mind are quiet, and it's so habitual to see the constellation Orion, and that habit energy has kind of like a dead, lifeless quality to it. But when the heart and mind are quiet and you just happen to look up, sometimes that flashing into existence of the reality of those stars can sink into your heart. And that's the moon appearing from behind the clouds. And you cannot will that to happen. It's a function of grace. It's a function of what Aiken Roshi calls enlightenment is an accident, but practice makes you accident prone. You cannot make the moonlight appear from behind the clouds. But you can watch the clouds from a certain vantage point, a certain attitudinal posture. And that watching actualizes the moonlight. But what you realize cannot be grasped by your... It doesn't become an object for you. You cannot put it up on a shelf and say, I've got it now. It's not an object of experience. So it's a very delicate, subtle kind of work. And it's a difficult kind of work, because to do the kind of work that I'm describing, you need to look at your samskaras. You need to look at your mental formations clearly, as comprehensively as possible, without judgment, without self-condemnation, but just see the cloud. It's just a cloud. It's just a samskara. It's just a mental formation. Now, what does this have to do with my work? And what does this have to do with the statement that I've made on numerous occasions that in the past year and a half, I've grown quite a bit, I think. I'm going to look at my notes for a moment. I have a samskara. I still have it. I probably will always have it. Wow, what was that sound? The wind? Yeah, I know. But I didn't recognize it at first until after the fact. The samskara that I have is the samskara of drug dealer, where I work every day. I drive into work, and I try to prepare myself because I know where I'm going. Usually what I do is I recite to myself the 8 verses of Training the Mind by Longri Thongpa, which I feel is very appropriate. Whenever I encounter beings of bad nature and those pressed by strong sins and sufferings, I will learn to regard that person as an excellent spiritual guide. And that's one of the 8, but they're in that vein of awakening bodhicitta, awakening the heart of limitless compassion through the recitation of these verses, or at least endeavoring, shall we say, to awaken the heart of limitless compassion. Because I still got my samskaras. I got the samskara of drug dealer. And so, but I'm watching it. I'm watching it. Who's watching it? The Blue Mountain is watching the samskaras. The witness of the samskaras is the Blue Mountain. I'd mention that. So I've got my samskaras, and I'm watching them. And so I come into town, to Chinatown, and I see drug dealers. I've got the samskara drug dealer as some being oppressing homeless people. And their cars are lined up on the street, and sometimes they're fairly nice, and they've got clean clothes and gold jewelry. And my samskara makes it very, very difficult for me at times to see the humanity of the drug dealers. And I've been aware of that samskara from day one. And I've been aware of it as a point of practice from day one, because I had the intellectual context with which to identify it as a prejudice and a presupposition. And so I've been able to some extent, practice with it from day one of working on the street. But I have a teacher who's helped me see the Blue Mountain within the clouds, or the moonlight behind the clouds. And his name is Lolo, and he's a small-time drug dealer. I first became aware of Lolo as a presence on the street when one of our homeless guests was very angry with me. He'd pulled a knife in the day room because somebody stole his... Bob, I love Bob, he's great, but he wasn't so great on that particular day. He was having a bad day. Somebody stole his coconut donut, and he's got significant mood swings, and he was down that day and angry and irritable. And he probably wouldn't have cut anybody, but he wanted to demonstrate how, can I say pissed off in this endo? He wanted to demonstrate how pissed off he was by pulling out the knife. And so he had to be out of the day room for 30 days. And he blamed me for that. And he was verbally harassing me every single morning that I came. Not in my presence, but among other people, he was making threats on my life or damaging my car. And it was Lolo who came up to him, the small-time drug dealer, who came up to him and said, "Hey, man, you can't be acting like that. That guy's just come in here to help out. You know, he doesn't deserve that. You know, you did what you did, and now you're copying an attitude, but it's got to stop. It's not, I probably didn't say it's not appropriate, but that was his message." And Bob respects Lolo. And so Bob modulated his behavior to some extent. And I go, "Oh, that, I know who that guy is. Yeah. Well, that's interesting. He's speaking up for me. The drug dealer." And so that got my attention. And said, "You know, he's not just a drug dealer. He's somebody that's noticed me and seems to have some measure of respect for me and is speaking up for me." Sometime after that, there was a homicide in the neighborhood. Maurice, a young black guy who was loved by a lot of people, loved Michael Jackson, would love to sing Michael Jackson songs on our open mic nights. His wife stabbed him to death right out there. Domestic squabble. And folks were saying, you know, there were people on both sides of the relationship. Most folks were siding with Maurice. They thought, you know, that she was always on his case because she knew he wouldn't hit her back. And she would sometimes hit him. I don't know the truth of that, but that was the general majority opinion on the street. Is that, and then she just finally lost her rage and killed him. And one of the things that I've had the sorrowful, beautiful honor of doing the last year and a half is maybe half a dozen memorial services for folks who died on the street. So I did one for Maurice. And we did it outside on a very beautiful spring day in the garden that we partnered with the university, CSUMB, to put up on the street in the neighborhood. And Lolo was attending that memorial service. Lolo and Maurice were very good friends, I discovered later. Because I was doing the ceremony. And as I was doing it, I looked over at Maurice, Lolo, and the tears were just pouring down. And he felt my gaze and looked into my eyes for a sustained period of time. And then he looked away, hung around for a little while, but then had to leave. It was just the grief of apparently was too much for him. And ever since then, we acknowledge each other on the street. You know, there's a bond. So he helped me see a little bit of moonlight through the clouds of my samsara. He helped me see a little bit of the humanity of a person, no matter what they're doing. And helped show how the samskaras, if all we see are samskaras, all we're seeing is ourself. It takes a Buddha and a Buddha to turn the wheel of the Dharma. It takes endeavoring to see beyond the samskaras by careful inventory of the samskaras, moment after moment, day after day. You just see the shit that comes up. Often it's shit. It's not always that. But see the samskaras, see the judgments, the opinions, the narratives you have about another person. We all have narratives. We can't live without samskaras. We can't stop at a stoplight if we don't know that you stop at a red stoplight. And we can't not see samskaras. I cannot have my own stories about Kokyo and my own feeling for him. It happens to be a feeling that I cherish and I don't suffer from. But it's not who he is. I can't know who he is. I can't know who another person is, but I can't help having a story about them. But that longing, it's an appropriate longing, it's not dukkha. That longing to see beyond the narrative, beyond the samskara. Is the thing. You cannot see the Blue Mountain. You cannot see the moonlight. It's not an object that you can grasp with your consciousness and possess. Suzuki Roshi talks about big mind. And big mind, he says, is something you cannot see. It's always on your side. But he also says, big mind is with whatever you see. It sounds a little bit contradictory. The Blue Mountain, the moonlight, is the one who sees the samskaras as samskaras, who sees a story about Kokyo, as just a story about Kokyo, the witness. The one who is not busy, another Zen story. And there's nobody there, but it's one thing to say nobody's there as some sort of Zen doctrine. It's another thing to witness, this samskara, this prejudice, this narrative, and then ask, who's doing the witnessing? And look for that one. And not find anything there except the vastness of the clouds dancing around the Blue Mountain, and you see the play of it, and you see that it's all wonder and light. But it's rigorous work. You just got to see clearly what's going on. And a lot of the time, being the beings we are, it's seeing where we're stuck, where we're afraid, where we're putting up defenses, encountering our fear, encountering the judgments and the resentments and the angers and the disappointments that our fear is generating. It's seeing my capacity or my tendency to see drug dealers instead of human beings. And then the humbling heartbreak of realizing that I haven't been seeing human beings, I've been seeing drug dealers, and then having a teacher like Lolo point that out to me, that, yeah, Rick, you can be prejudiced too. You can cover a person's humanity with an opinion or a fear or a condemnation for behavior. So, and that's a pretty hearty Dharma food. It it's tough to get down. And the only thing, it's not a warm fuzzy. It's not it's not peaceful. It's not placid. You know, it's rigorous work. And the last thing, I wanted to try to talk about is, given the, I almost started to cry this evening, remembering Lolo because of the poignancy of it. I cherish it, even though it hurts. Why? That's the final point, is why bother? Why bother doing this work when it's such hardy fare, when you have to encounter the limits of your compassion, the limits of your openness, the limits of your willingness to understand another human being and connect with another human being? An open heart is an open heart. Last Saturday, I was sitting at Point Lobos. I don't know if anyone here, I'm sure somebody here, a few people here probably know Point Lobos, and it's a beautiful place. And it was a beautiful day, and I saw my first whale when there was this mist came up. I go, oh, there she blows, you know. And I watched that area for a while, and this black arced shape came up, and then later I saw the magnificent tail fin. And so I've seen whales like in Marineland, but I never saw a whale of the open sea before. And it was a beautiful early afternoon, light dancing on the water. And I was in a state of bliss because I felt pretty open to it. And that ocean, no pun intended this time, I have to say, pun intended, it was an oceanic experience, you know. And then I happened to turn my head and I saw the fine houses in the Marin Headlands. And you know, I remember as a young man, I dreamt of having a nice house with lots of wood, like in the Zendo, lots of wood everywhere, you know, polished, nice mahogany and stuff, and a gorgeous view of the ocean and nature. Not because I wanted status, I don't think, so much status and being high on the food chain, but because I appreciated beauty, and I wanted to be around beauty, and I was envious of people who had the opportunity to live around beauty. As a young man, I would find myself sometimes thinking that as I was a starving musician in New York. So I asked myself, Rick, do you think now you would be happier in a place like that? Do you think that would deepen your appreciation of what you're seeing right now? And I said, not, probably not. And I thought to myself, and these are just some scars, these are just thoughts, I thought to myself that if I owned that house, I might entertain the notion that I owned the view too, and that would probably cheapen it. That would probably limit the experience. And then it occurred to me that the work that I've been doing and it's not, I'm not that great of a practitioner, but I have been trying. I have been trying to learn how to open my heart on the street with the incredible despair and hopelessness and misery that I see every single day. That has opened my heart to this. And I can appreciate this in direct proportion to the work that I've been doing with my samskaras on the street. An open heart is an open heart. Like Lao Tzu says, in a rather, it almost sounds prosaic to quote him to say, "Without, we know beauty is beauty only because there is ugliness." There's a deeper truth than just contrast there. An open heart is an open heart. To the degree that we can open our heart to the suffering of the world, the boundlessness of Buddha's realm can also get in. Time's almost up, and I don't want to use all the time up, but I just want to see if I had any pithy closing statement. But no, I think that's about it. Well, thank you very much. We have some time. We have some conversation. I'd be happy to do that. Yes?
I was struck by the comment you made about grace as an assistance. And so was, while you were telling the story about Lolo and your longing to see, that seemed to me that sincere longing was the only way you would actually see the moonlight, or Lolo.
Mm-hmm.
In you, no?
I am an advocate of holy longing. And I remember a lecture of Suzuki Roshi's that I read where he talked about the reason we say to limit your desires is so that you can extend them limitlessly, when that kind of desire is Buddha's desire. So the desire to actually open your heart to whatever arises is a legitimate aspiration. The word aspiration might be more politically correct in Dharma circles than longing, but it's the same thing. And the aspiration is what gives birth to... The aspiration is bodhicitta, the desire to learn how to love all sentient beings. It's not... I don't think, maybe I don't know if this is dharmically correct or not, I don't think it is the capacity to unfailingly love all sentient beings. It's that longing. It's having the capacity to comprehend the value of that longing. I think that's what the word bodhicitta means. And bodhicitta literally means enlightenment mind, the mind of enlightenment. But contextually, in the Indo-Tibetan tradition, it means the aspiration to become enlightened, not because you want to be an enlightened being, but because you want to be helpful, you want to be skillful and effective in helping sentient beings. And that's the longing that that I pray I'm talking about. Yes?
I think I heard you refer to Zazen as attitudinal posture.
Yeah.
I'm intrigued by that. I've never really heard it described that way, and I very much resonate with that description. Could you say a little more?
Well, I think that's Tozan's poem, is that's the posture. The blue mountain, is the father of the white cloud. The white cloud is the son of the blue mountain. All day long, they're interacting with each other, yet not disturbing each other. So when you're sitting Zazen, you leave the front door and the back door of your mind open. You let the thoughts come. You don't push them away. You let them go. You don't offer them tea. That's Blue Mountain sitting, where thoughts are just clouds. And there's an attitude, a posture, an attitude. Finding the right word for it is difficult. But there's the capacity to, there's some imperturbability in the midst of the thinking. And there's not hopping on the thought and going for a ride with it. It doesn't bug you. It does bug you, but there's also somewhere within your awareness that you're in tune with or in contact with that is unperturbed. Shame arises, and on some level there's perturbance. But in Zazen, there's underneath that perturbance is the one who is not perturbed. And there's a whole koan about that, the one who is not busy. And so that's the attitudinal posture, holding the whole mix of things like that. At least that's what I think. Yeah. Well, shall we go have some tea? Zar numberless, I vow to fade them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are